It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Not guilty by reason of insanity is one of the most controversial and unsatisfying verdicts in a court of law for those seeking a conviction. In recent years, the role of mental competency has become an even more widespread and confusing topic in the courtroom. Programs dedicated to the intersection of law and neuroscience have formed at universities nationwide, and the MacArthur Foundation has funded a multi-million dollar grant to study the matter. Now, MRI and PET scans have been introduced to add the broken brain defense into the mix. Journalist Kevin Davis has covered these issues, writing for the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Reader, USA Today, and many others. In his new book, The Brain Defense, he looks at the intersection between neuroscience and America's courtrooms and examines some particularly shocking cases. And we welcome Kevin Davis to the program. Kevin, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
In 1991, a 65-year-old man in New York City committed a pretty brutal act. What did Herbert Weinstein do, and why did he say he did it?
He was a retired ad executive from New York, as you said, and he, throughout his life, was known as being calm and cool, never did a violent thing in his life. Well, he got into an argument with his wife. She scratched him in the face, and he impulsively went for her throat, and he squeezed and he squeezed, and he killed her. And so in a panic, he dragged her over to the bedroom window, opened it up, they lived 12 floors up, and he tossed her out, and he thought he'd make it look like a suicide. But the police kind of figured things out pretty quickly, and Weinstein said, yes, I did it. I lost it. So he did confess to the crime. What happened, however, was later on, several months later, while he was having some medical tests and psychiatric examinations, the doctors discovered that he had a cyst the size of an orange growing inside his brain on the frontal lobe. And therefore, Weinstein's lawyers thought, aha, I have a criminal defense.
So basically the idea was it wasn't him. He had this medical malady that made him incompetent. What did they end up arguing for? A lesser sentence? That he wasn't responsible for the crime?
So what his lawyer did was put on what he called a temporary insanity defense. He wanted to make the argument that Herbert Weinstein, because he had this cyst in his brain, was unable to control himself and his impulses. And what he did was he brought a PET scan into court with him, which shows brain activity. And his argument was, you can see from the PET scan that the area around where his cyst was low. In other words, it wasn't functioning properly. The biggest argument in court was whether to admit that evidence or not. And the judge did admit the evidence, the PET scan evidence. I don't want to give away the ending, but that's sort of what happened at the basis of the trial. And by allowing that evidence in, that was sort of a landmark decision in terms of allowing brain scans in court in determining whether somebody was guilty or not guilty.
So was this the first time that brain scans had been used in the courtroom?
It wasn't the first time brain scans had been used in the courtroom. They'd been used in death penalty sentencing hearings, mitigation hearings. In other words, people who had already been convicted of murder, sometimes their lawyers would put on brain scans to show juries and judges that, yes, my client did it. However, they have, you know, diminished mental capacity and so forth. And they would use it as an argument to try to spare them from the death penalty. But with the Weinstein case, it was the first time a PET scan was allowed in a trial in which they were going to determine guilt or no guilt.
Brain differences have often been linked to aberrant behavior. And I think the public really wants to accept that when people do something horrific, like Herbert Weinstein did, that it's because something just went wrong with their brain, that somebody that has a perfectly normal brain wouldn't do this. For instance, you write about the University of Texas tower shooter, Charles Whitman. There's research and speculation on his brain.
Right. Charles Whitman, what was interesting about Whitman was he had an inkling that something was wrong with him. Now, Charles Whitman had gunned down, I believe it was 16 people at the University of Texas, and he came well-armed and well-prepared, so there's clearly forethought in his actions. But he left a letter that police found after he died that indicated that he knew something was wrong, and he actually suggested that they do an autopsy and look in his brain to see if there was some sort of anomaly. And sure enough, there was a tiny little tumor deep inside of his brain. And so it raised the question, did that little growth cause Charles Whitman brain dysfunction and lead to his behavior. You hear arguments on both sides, but it was clear that he knew something was wrong, and that was what was really chilling about that case. And so, you know, this brain defense concept raises some interesting questions, because it's not quite at the level of insanity where somebody has a chronic, serious psychiatric illness. A lot of the people I write about in the book are high-functioning, regular people who have something going on in their brains that may have affected their behavior, and so they don't really reach the classical definition of insanity.
It's not just a tumor or a cyst that prompts the suggestion of brains not working quite right and changing the behavior of individuals. In recent years, we've seen a lot of research into head trauma, repeated concussions. Mm-hmm. Even PTSD has been suggested as causing behavioral changes. And we've even seen this recently where a PTSD defense has come in with a veteran.
Yes, and that's not uncommon. And in combination with the PTSD defense, and PTSD is, you know, an accepted mental health diagnosis, it is complicated by a lot of vets who have suffered from mild traumatic brain injury to serious traumatic brain injury. As you may know, it's been considered the invisible injury. And one of the signature wounds of many vets who came back didn't even realizing that they had mild traumatic brain injuries, which occur even if you're in the vicinity of an explosion. You don't even need to be, you know, at ground zero, so to speak, to suffer a traumatic brain injury. And so put that in combination with PTSD, and there are clearly vets who are suffering in ways that we may never have anticipated and whose behaviors are changing in ways no one had ever anticipated.
We're talking with Kevin Davis. He's the author of The Brain Defense, Murder in Manhattan, and The Dawn of Neuroscience in America's Courtroom. There is an organization in Chicago called the Brain Injury Clubhouse. What did you learn from the membership of this clubhouse?
You know, I began visiting the Brain Injury Clubhouse a few years ago just out of curiosity, because it just sounded so interesting, and I had never heard of anything like this before. So the Brain Injury Clubhouse is a service that helps people who are recovering from traumatic brain injuries or brain surgery kind of relearn some of the skills that they may have lost from their injuries or due to their injuries. You know, for example, people go there to learn how to use computers, how to apply for jobs, how to use silverware and cutlery again, and also just to have the companionship and camaraderie of others who are also recovering from traumatic brain injuries. You know, once people get out of a traditional rehabilitation hospital, there is still a long road to go in terms of recovering fully from a traumatic brain injury. And so the Brain Injury Clubhouse is one such place where people can learn and relearn some of those skills, again, that they had lost as a result of their injuries.
How do neuroscientists feel about this research and these scans being used in the courtroom? I would imagine that some are for it, some aren't. But is there any kind of consensus amongst them? I mean, these are complicated issues, and I imagine scientists feel that there's so much research still to be done.
Sure. You know, most serious neuroscientists are not performing their research in the service of lawyers in the courts. I think this sort of happened accidentally. In other words, lawyers saw opportunities through neuroscience to mount new kinds of criminal defenses. Now, there are some neuroscientists who are regular expert witnesses and who fly around the country and who work with defense attorneys. And then on the other side, there are people who counter those expert witnesses. So it's still a very contentious issue, Steve. I don't think the serious neuroscientific researchers are interested really in having their work translate to criminal courts. It's a huge leap, and I think, you know, good criminal defense attorneys seek any kinds of defense and arguments they can for their clients. And I think they saw neuroscience is a unique opportunity to bring in a kind of criminal defense that hadn't been seen before and quite frankly raises some really interesting questions about responsibility and free will. And they really opened a door to a new area that is still kind of being written as we speak.
Kevin Davis is the author of The Brain Defense, and he's been joining us this morning to talk about neuroscience and the brain in the courtroom. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
This is the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.